Okay, so this is a talk on bodhicitta, which is chapter two of my book, The 10 Fields of Zen Practice, a Primer for Practitioners, which I am releasing one chapter at a time on my podcast. And I just count on for those of you who will have listen to this episode already. I just count on a live Dharma talk presentation with interactions with people and whatever to be a different experience than listening to the podcast. And certainly, if the podcast has sprung some questions in your mind, you're welcome to bring them. So bodhicitta means the mind, the way-seeking mind, or some Bodhi is enlightenment or awakening, and citta, it means mind. So it's the Bodhi mind, it's the mind of enlightenment, the way-seeking mind. So I'll explain a little bit more about that. Or I don't know, I guess I'll do that right now. See. It'll be clear by the end of the talk why you might translate bodhicitta as way seeking mind. All right. So bodhicitta, or I'm calling this the first field of Zen practice, because without it, we would never seek out practice. We would never, and we would not continue on the path of practice. So without, it's like kind of the prerequisite. And it first arises related to dissatisfaction. So, this is one of the first messages of Buddhism, is that there's no permanent lasting satisfaction to be found in conditioned things. What I'm calling, well, I like to call like objective attainments. So this might be something that you attain, possess, a position, a relationship, or something in the external world, but it also can be turned on ourselves. We can relate to ourselves as an object. So you would know, like, I would be happy only if I could get better self-discipline. I could do this or stop doing this or be this way or stop being this way. So in that sense, even though that kind of seems like it'd be consistent with practice, there's a way we can just make ourselves as just another object to mess with and change. And therefore, if we could only do that, then we would be happy and at peace. So that basic level of dissatisfaction is just kind of par for the course. But this kind of, there's a deeper level of dissatisfaction that arises in the as a precursor to bodhicitta, which is dissatisfaction about the way we habitually address dissatisfaction. Right? So like, but this is why it's very rare for young people to come to Buddhism, because they feel that dissatisfaction too. Like, if only I could do this, then I'll be happy if I do this. But they're still out there trying to make that happen. They're still out there, like, maybe if I do this and I know and this will be cool. It's usually only after a while that we go, either we haven't been able to attain the things that we want to attain, or we've attained them and then we're like, still not, it's not really doing it for me. So that's where the dissatisfaction, like a spiritual dissatisfaction or discontent arises. So there's a word for this in the Theravadin tradition called Samvega. So Tenisaro Bhikkhu explains, just love this passage because I relate to it so much as what brought me to practice. It's a hard word to translate because it covers such a complex range, at least three clusters of feelings at once. The oppressive sense of shock, dismay, and alienation that comes with realizing the futility and meaninglessness of life as it's normally lived. a chastening sense of our own complicity, complacency, and foolishness, and having let ourselves live so blindly, and an anxious sense of urgency in trying to find a way out of the meaningless cycle. This is a cluster of feelings that we've all experienced at one time or another in the process of growing up, but I don't know a single English term that adequately covers all three. Such a term would be useful to have, and maybe that's reason enough for simply adopting the word samvega into our language. So to whatever degree that we might feel this, which can be, it can be acute, I felt it quite acutely, or it can be a little more subtle, just a sense of like, you know, life is short. What do I want to have? How do I want to have lived? You know, like there's much more out there. I could, somebody recently said, some point along his path, he said, I could be more. So this spiritual discontent is something that society is very uncomfortable with. Our discontent tends to arouse others' doubts, which they don't really want to look at. And or, if we're starting to question kind of the whole way that we ordinarily go about trying to address dissatisfaction and achieve happiness, you know, that really threatens people's worldview, right? So clearly what you really need is you just need, you know, more of the same, right? You need to change your life situation. You need to find a better job. You need a better partner. You need to, you know, work on yourself, something like that. And then you'll be happy. But if we refuse to just accept that answer, or we cannot just accept that answer, that being dismissed, then there's a chance that this bodhicitta will arise. And at first it may be a kind of intuition that there's something else. It can be a stubborn refusal to accept that there's not a better way. Or like as in the case of the Buddha, it's some encounter, whether that's an encounter with a person or with a tradition or a teaching or something. It's always an encounter with a person or something that a person has created or left behind, right? So it's, we encounter someone who suggests a different way to be, someone, you know, something what we read that, oh, there really is something else. And so this little tender shoot of bodhicitta is born. And we think of it as when it first arises, it's very tender and delicate. You know, that first hope that maybe there is something different. And it can easily be squashed. I mean, I just think this, you know, the little metaphor here of a tender shoot is perfect. It has been easily like crushed by, you know, the cynicism of the people around us, lack of support, or by our own negativity, our own just like, here you go again, just hoping that something's going to happen. This is going to be just like all the other times. It's just going to end up miserable, you know. So you can squash your own little bodhicitta shoot. So it's important to take care of this, to recognize this is an important aspect of our practice and to cultivate it. So I'll be talking about that. But, you know, the first step, what this bodhicitta does is have us take the first step on the path. You know, there's, you know, in a largely convert community like this, the first step is usually like picking up your first Zen book, listening to your first Buddhist podcast. You know, all right, I guess this is the weekend. I'm actually going to go visit that Zen center. You know, like doing, you know, that can, there can be quite a lot of inhibition to like stepping in and doing that thing for the first time. So there's that, and then there's certainly, there's plenty of people in this country and over in Europe, where some of our folks come from, who are born into Buddhism. I mean, there's been Western Buddhists now long enough that they're even having kids. So there's people who have been raised in it. And then, of course, there are people who culturally their background is Buddhist. But even for those folks, that at some point there comes where like they decide to investigate it for themselves. And, you know, like as a child, you just kind of absorb it. And then at a certain point, you're going to develop a different relationship to it. And the bodhicitta would be spurring that on. And then the bodhicitta continues to motivate us. And hopefully that intuition and hope turns more into faith as the path seems reliable, helps us relieve suffering, then it develops into confidence in the path. Doesn't have to be confidence in ourselves, just confidence in the path. So this this bodhicitta cannot be taken for granted. Sometimes people wonder why their practice is languishing, or, you know, feels kind of uninspired, or they feel like it should be deeper, could be deeper. And typically, what we look for, we look, well, why is that happening? Well, most of us think it's a lack of self-discipline. Or maybe we're just meditating wrong, or maybe we're studying the wrong thing, or maybe words is the wrong teacher and the wrong, who knows? But we tend to look for objective explanations for why our practice doesn't feel so alive or it's kind of languishing. But, you know, the question really to ask ourselves first is, you know, what is the state of our bodhicitta? So when one of the ways that this looks, when it looks weaker, we find ourselves getting kind of lazy or disinterested, sliding back into old habit patterns, prioritizing fun and comfort and excitement or pleasure over practice. And intellectually, we know life is short. And if we're really sad and we're honest with ourselves, we're like, all right, well, you know, achieving some kind of peace and whatever, that I want to do that before I die, but, you know, I'll do that next week. I'll do that next year. But another way that our bodhicitta can suffer is to be overrun by weeds. So to continue our plant metaphor, and the weeds are like self-centered ambition that takes the form of our practice. So now we've just taken the same approach to practice that we've taken to all the other things, right? If only I can meditate really well, if only I understood that teaching, if only I, you know, whatever, now, then I would be really happy. Which is just, you know, it's going to lead to the same kind of dissatisfaction, even though the subject of it is our practice. So how cultivate bodhicitta without making the weeds flourish? And learning to do this is a part of our practice. It's not something that you just, you know, magically know how to do. It's just basically over the whole course of our practice, and most of us anyway are going to go like, you know, too much striving, too much kind of lackadaisical. All right. And I always find like, I've gotten confident that if I get too complacent and kind of lazy, like, I just trust that I'm going to get dissatisfied. I don't worry about that too much. Like, oh my God, I'm getting complacent. It's just, you know, at a certain point, I'm going to say, oh, God, just like, the sincere desire not to just live that way arises, right? So then it kind of goes over to the other side. And then when there's practice starts to feel, if practice causes us angst, like, oh, I'm not good enough. It's not art, you know, then we're going too much on the striving side. Practice is not supposed to make us more unhappy. Just like if it's making you more unhappy, then your whole relationship to it needs to change a little bit. So it's not easy. As Zen Master Dogen said, you have to force yourself to arouse Bodhi mind and practice the Buddha Dharma. Who has such Bodhi mind from the beginning? Arousing what is difficult to arouse, practicing what is difficult to practice. In this way, you will naturally progress in the Buddha Dharma. Each of us has Buddha nature. Do not meaninglessly deprecate yourself. So, how to cultivate bodhicitta? I think what's valuable is to recognize its importance. Like I was saying, when you notice something doesn't quite feel right in your practice, what is the state of your bodhicitta? And then turning toward and to kind of arouse that bodhicitta, the motivation, the sincere motivation, which frankly, if you are in that kind of samvega, that spiritual discontent that I talked about, the more intense that is, generally speaking, the more intense your bodhicitta. Like if you're really suffering, you don't really have to worry about this that much, unless your tendency maybe is to like try to numb out and distract yourself with other things. But like you can be really motivated to practice by pain. But when we need to focus it and arouse it a little bit. And we do that by turning toward our remaining discontent, inhibition, reactivity, toward our unresolved stuff, toward the limits of our understanding and manifestation, which basically, like the Dharma is infinite. Skillfulness is infinite. Like so the Bodhisattva never says, good enough. You know, there's like a Dharma's, there's always more growth is possible. No one of us is ever going to perceive all the Dharmic truths. So there's like, there's no end to this. Does that mean, so it can sound a little bit like Zen is an endless self-improvement project, right? We start to get a little content and we're like, all right, well, where are your flaws? You still have flaws. You better chase down your flaws. But it's not, it ideally is not like that. That kind of thing is, if you think about it, is self-centered, right? Where once again, we're trying to fix the self. And if the self was only perfect, then we would be happy. But ideally, we look at this like, this is all, it's all optional. It's all completely optional. There's no deity up in the sky watching what you do and expecting anything. Ideally, there's no teachers, there's no Sangha members, there's no anyone who is just like, yeah, he's got more work to do. Think of this as like, you have your own little sprout or whatever, maybe it's more than a sprout of bodhicitta, and you can only nurture that. You can only nurture your own sincere motivation and desire. What do you really want? It doesn't matter what the next person wants. It doesn't matter what you think you should do. What do you really want? And I think any of us, if we look within our hearts, there's like, I would love to become more open and receptive. You know, I would love, you know, I've long said, and this is like just, this isn't so much an ambition to work on, but just kind of a way of framing of life, that I would love to live each day as if it is my last. Because when I know when I get caught up and I'm like, you know, annoyed and overwhelmed and reactive or something like that, I'm forgetting how quickly this life goes and how precious it is and how, you know, I have frequently been able to, you know, take a larger perspective where it's just like, good Lord, why can't, this is nothing. Like, why get upset about this? So that, you know, I've held that aspiration for many, many years and didn't see all that much progress on it, but just kind of holding it. And I, you know, it's been only fairly recently that I'm like, you know, I feel like more times throughout the day, maybe like 5 to 10 times throughout the day, just I'm doing something and I'm just like doing it to get it done. Just pause and just be like, wow, look at this. So there's always like this aspiration for growth or freedom from suffering, you know, overcoming anxiety, whatever, that we can return to and can inspire, sincerely inspire our bodhicitta. And then just some practical ways to inspire bodhicitta is to challenge yourself in terms of practice. You know, there's people who are participating in term student for the first time this term. And that's often, it's a real way. Some people that find that a real challenge to like tell their life story and open up to other people, that's a challenge. It's any of these challenges, right? It's like, that doesn't mean you have to go take that challenge, but that is a way you can do it. You can come to retreat. If you have witnessed Mondo before and you never presented a verse, maybe you'd go out on a limb, you present a verse. I mean, there's these, and then of course there's ways outside of practice that we can challenge ourselves in these new ways. And thereby become more more connected with our, I mean, it sounds like kind of negative, like connected with our limitations, but that's kind of the case, right? That's where our edge of learning is to go out and notice, oh, I would really like to, I'd like to do better at that next time. There's opening up to teachings and teachers. There's seeking the company of good spiritual friends. So I just started releasing a two-part podcast episode on good spiritual friends. And that's like, when you are surrounded by people who similarly are practicing and are excited about it, are intrigued by the nature of reality, whatever, that is going to inspire you, as opposed to perhaps spending time with people who are going to be like, you know, oh, what did you do? What did you do at your Buddhist center? Oh, that sounds like a waste of time. I mean, hopefully you don't have too many people in your life who say that. But, you know, you could expose yourself to people who are definitely not helping you nurture your bodhicitta. You can live by vow. First of all, building a habit of practice when bodhicitta is strong. So rather, you can kind of count on the fact that sometimes your bodhicitta is going to be quite alive, and sometimes it's going to be just like, why do I do this again? But if you've built up a habit of practice and you just like, okay, I sit, I go to Sangha a couple of times a month, all right, like, and you just keep on doing that, then pretty, I mean, it might not be true for everybody, but I've certainly found that I will not disengage from the practice based just on my own whim, right? I have a habit, and at a certain point, you know, things clear. Maybe life is really too busy for a while, and then it opens up again, and I'll be like, oh yeah, this is why I do this. Living by vow, that's a very related thing. So it's a very big thing in Zen to make a vow, like being vowing to be part of the term student program, or, you know, we receive the precepts and we vow to have these be part of our life. So those vows remain even when our bodhicitta flags. And those vows were made, you know, out of our deep bodhicitta. So they can kind of serve as a reminder and a touchstone. Like, I don't remember why I did this, but at some point I decided this was really important. And then you keep shaping your life in that way. And I thought of giving yourself credit for how you've already changed. So helping to increase that sense of faith and confidence in the path. It's very easy to just continue to focus on our flaws and limitations and not reflect on how practice might have has positively affected us. And then just to be grateful for bodhicitta, because we don't really, we can do these things to cultivate it, but once again, this is such a perfect metaphor. Like, we did not create that seed. We have, to cultivate means to, create the proper conditions for something to grow and thrive. The farmer does not go out and they can't make that plant grow, right? They can only facilitate that growth. So I know at certain points I wanted to kind of take credit for my bodhicitta, how yes, I have way seeking mind. And I don't know, it seems like those people don't. But the way the Buddhists, in the Buddhist way of viewing this, is we all have that seed, but we are not really in charge of when it sprouts, when it arises. It just does. We are blessed with that the same way that we might be blessed with intelligence or health or a loving family. It's just, that's cool. My bodhicitta arose and now I can help take care of it. But one of the things that's kind of cool about thinking it like that is, to cultivate this sense of gratitude and not take it for granted, but also that we don't judge other people in terms of where they are in their process. We say everybody has this potential. Everyone has this seed. And we cannot make it sprout in somebody else. No matter how much we tell them about Buddhism, no matter how much we tell them that, seeking happiness and conditioned things isn't going to provide lasting happiness, that doesn't help. That's why Buddhists don't evangelize, because it doesn't help. It doesn't, if you're really going to do the practice, it has to be something that you're ready to do and you're interested in doing, you want to do. And to come back around then to that kind of that mind that seeks the way, mind of enlightenment, mind that seeks the way. So can think of Bodhi mind in this kind of utilitarian way, like it's what causes us to seek out practice and keeps us on the path. But it's really, it's the mind of enlightenment. So it means that which we are seeking is causing us to seek. So we already have this awakened nature, if you will, and that is what says there's gotta be a better way. It's like it's calling to us to realize it and to manifest it. So if that kind of, in a sense, that is awakened mind. Awakened mind is what causes us to seek out the path and to keep going on the path. And finally, there's seen as So in the like Shanti Deva's Way of the Bodhisattva celebrates bodhicitta quite a magnificent extent. And there's a sense that this bodhicitta is not it's not valuable only in what it brings us as a, at a later date. It's not valuable in the sense that, okay, now this is arisen, I'm seeking the way, I'm going to, you know, practice, and then at some point, you know, whatever I achieve, that's great. Because, you know, bodhicitta has motivated me along the way. There's a sense that bodhicitta is instantly redemptive. Like bodhicitta arising right now, like is the mind of enlightenment right now. It's not just about like what happens later. And if you just think about this in terms of, you know, we may for the rest of our lives be, you know, have kind of mediocre practice and never really get over our irritability. And just, you know, we may just continue to make mistakes, hurt people's feelings. But in any given circumstance where we recognize that is happening, and then this Bodhi mind arises, like, you know, it doesn't have to be this way. There's another, I want to be a different way. I'm sorry about that. You know, like the whole situation is changed by that momentary arising of Bodhi mind. All right, so we have plenty of time for comments or questions. James?
On the topic of keeping bodhicitta re-energized and I'm trying to find a succinct way to put this, but I wonder what your thoughts are on one of the, like, I can pinpoint the exact day, I'm not the date, but I know the exact day and time that my bodhicitta first arose, or not first arose, but at least that I recognized that this is what it was, because, you know, it had been difficulties, blah, blah, blah. I was trying to make some changes. There were still some difficulties. And I said to my wife, because I was having trouble with my son with discipline or whatnot, parenting. And every time we had a bad altercation or a bad interaction, I would be sitting there going, what would the Dalai Lama do? And that was my WWDLD, you know, like, you know, bumper sticker. What would the Dalai Lama do? And I don't know. And I had no idea why this popped into my mind, but it was, I realized later after a couple of weeks of that, I was like, because the Dalai Lama would have handled it completely the opposite of the way that you handled it, James, you know? And so there was like something about that quality of being that I could see him handling the situation so much better. And I turned to my wife one night, literally laying there in bed, 9 o'clock, and I said, do we have any books by the Dalai Lama? And she said, no, but we have something by Thich Nhat Hanh that my mom gave me. And so she went to the bookshelf and she pulled out the Thich Nhat Hanh Being Peace. And I read the first chapter and it literally just blew my mind apart. You know, it's like, I have been going at this the wrong way. So like that moment in time, like if I ever find myself kind of slipping, I go back to that moment because I felt like I was already kind of moving there. I was trying to move in this direction, but I didn't know what to call it or how to quantify it. And it's like the practice coming to me through this vision or whatever, this thought, and then the you know, Thich Nhat Hanh's teachings, like, was such a turning point in my life that I go back to that moment. You know, if I feel myself slipping, it's like, remember, you know, that night, you know, however many years ago now, and why you're doing this, you know, why you're here. And, you know, I don't want to make it like a punishing myself, like you said, you get like, oh, get back at them. But to kind of use that as a motivation, like to help reinvigorate that bodhicitta. So, anyway, just wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
I don't really have anything to add to that. That was lovely. That was lovely. Thank you for sharing. And Leah.
I have a imperfect sense of frustration sometimes when there is somebody that I I love or a friend, and they could really use this in some form, and I know I could see it. And I think back to the time when I was younger, and I think, well, I could have really used this at that time if there were someone to tell me or talk to me or give me a book or, you know, like, I don't know. Like, it seems like a very fine line between being evangelical, which I know that it's everyone's practice is their own and comes from themselves, but, and also like, helping at just the right time. And I'm thinking, is it really a binary? Is it really zero or one? Is there a rarely subtle point where you might be able to influence, just, you know, just water the sprout or, you know, whatever it is. So I don't know. I feel like there's a little.
Yeah. And I don't think it's binary as well, because sometimes, right, you might say something or offer something and it does not apparently make any difference, but you don't know that over the course of years. Maybe that just kind of goes in there and contributes in some way. But I mean, I basically keep the rule of thumb is like, you know, I want to give this much, so I should give this much,
right?
You know, like, just like, yeah, have you thought about what you might do inside even if your circumstances don't change?
Yeah, yes.
Or, you know, I don't know, like, I mean, I just, and I only, the only reason I have that is because just how many times I've, you know, given something, mentioned something, explained something, invited somebody to come to the Zen Center, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, no, it's like my parents, bless them, like, they have both read my Zen Living book. I mean, it's like, and somehow they like read that whole book, and it did not think for an instant did it ever cross their mind that they might actually practice. It's like, that's interesting. But I mean, who knows? That doesn't mean that it didn't influence them in some way. So I don't know. But yes, I don't think it's binary, but it's very, but it's not just, you know, the Dharma specifically. This is, you know, everybody knows this is how people are. You can't really offer them advice. Jimmy.
Is there somebody?
I don't think so. And remember, folks who are in the cloud, raise hand should now be just like right there at the bottom of your screen. You don't even have to go to reactions anymore. I just placed raise hand right there. All right.
I love the last question. And the way I look at it from afar is, it is not up to me to fix someone else. The way I can influence and give that little bit is through my own behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a lot easier said than done, because I find myself in the position of, she's just got, you know, a lot, and then I have to back off. And if I go over that edge, what I find out is, what is wrong with you is exactly what is wrong with me. But in the spirit of this discussion, how about people that you're caring for?
Mm-hmm.
They have a practice and they're sick. And all I can hear is, I can't, I can't, I can't. What do you do with that?
Well, I think about So I'm doing my podcast episode on Dharma friendship, and it's two parts. So in this first one, I don't get to it yet, but the second part, I'm going to be talking about the Buddha's his little friendship sutta. And one of the things that he says is, when misfortune strikes, a good friend does not abandon you. That's it. Can't fix. It's and the good friend endures what is hard to endure. It's hard to watch people suffer. It's hard to watch our loved ones suffer, especially when we see in some ways that they are causing some of their own suffering. Endure what's hard to endure and don't abandon. And I love that don't abandon. It's just kind of like, that's it. You know, it's just like, and how do you not abandon? You just give a call. Here I am. Haven't left. I don't know what to do. I got nothing for you. I got no answers. Can't fix anything. But I'm here. John.
As usual, these talks arouse so many different thoughts and questions in me. In describing that feeling of samvega, that you know, either a more sudden or maybe a gradual and ongoing feeling of dismay or shock or spiritual longing, or and then that transition into bodhicitta, it made me think a great deal about my personal narrative, which I won't go into any great detail here and now, but it made me think of how it the interesting relationship between those two things, the friction of that feeling of dismay kind of lights that fire. So I look back on these things I might judge as like, oh, these are bad things that I experienced, but they're the very things that brought me to the place I am in my longing for these greater things, as well as the development such as I've been able to produce in my actually achieving some of these things. So I think that's an interesting relationship. And I think it's one that's profoundly human, right? And of course it's reflected in the story of the Buddha, but I think we all have our own stories that mirror that.
Yeah.
And another thing you brought up, I thought is interesting, is just for those of us who are at the lash of our own self-expectations, which is pretty much everyone to a greater or lesser degree, I was thinking of the idea of target fixation. So it's something that happens with pilots or motorcyclists. You fixate on the thing that you're trying to avoid, and your very fixation makes you drive right into it. And there's this kind of something that can happen with the very practice itself, is that when one is not light with yourself, like there seems to be like a lightness of touch and a generosity that you ideally are going to provide yourself as well as other people, that prevents exactly this sort of like ironic disaster of your very desires to avoid these things and to get these things is the very thing that gets in your way. This over fixation on the judgment and rightness of what you're doing. I say that from some experience.
Yeah.
These are just some thoughts that this
arousing. Yeah, I mean, all along in practice, at any stage, there are things that we're trying to do or trying not to do, and it just us like just doesn't, it's not working the way that we want it to work, and it feels like that means our practice is wrong, that we're practicing wrong because we haven't figured out how to do it. And yet, I mean, the practice is is learning how to do it. The practice is learning how to be who we are. And in the process of like guiding our practice, there is the lesson of no self. There's the lesson of like, there's no little executive I in here who's in charge of this whole process, who's decided we're going to do this and then we're going to do that. And then the unruly mind does this, the unruly body does this. Am I going to need to get everybody into order so that they all just obey what I want to do? Like, that's not how human beings work. Psychologists know this now. Buddhists have known this for ages. It's not how we work. So how do we practice? How do we make any changes in our life if we can't just go, all right, this is what's going to happen? So like you were talking, you made me think of how my teacher Kyogen said, when you make an intention, it's like the law of physics, like equal and opposite intention comes up. It's just like, because we're fighting ourselves when we're doing that. It's like, we are going to, and I just to tell a story of myself, like, I've always wanted to be able to get up really early and do all kinds of stuff before I have to, you know, do what I have to do, right? So I'm gonna get up really early, I'm gonna meditate for a whole hour, I'm gonna blah, 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 blah. And like, I also need a lot of sleep. So like, there was one self who set the alarm for early, and it was another self who wakes up and says, screw that. I did it over and over and over for years and years. Like, just, that is not, this isn't working. This doesn't actually work. This is not how change happens. So there's like that. Yeah, practice is about learning how do we actually make this change happen without falling into that delusion, without tripping ourselves up and getting in our own way. It's an art, but it's a great delight to start to learn how to navigate this life.
A quick tag to what you said totally resonates with me, those selves. I think that one thing that has helped me be at ease with myself is to admit that I am multiple, like I am multitudes, or I contain multitudes, like Whitman's, you know, and that this sort of simplistic unitary idea of self is, it's tyrannical to some extent unhelpful.
And just a delusion. It's not true. Brian.
We're so fortunate nowadays compared to what it was like. I mean, I still remember perhaps in France on a Bodhicitta mind, like looking, I always was looking for something. I was always searching for something. But when I started to look for it, like, I'm living in Africa. There's not much access 30 years ago to internet. There was no internet. There were no books. I mean, the first book I ever picked up was The Living Dead. Yeah, you know, it's a very dry thing to read, you know, and that's your first introduction, and you don't stick up, you don't stay with it after that, because it just turns you off. But now there's so much stuff out there on the internet that you can see it all the time, and so for a person has an opportunity, which caused me to think about the book that you're just referring to, Rebecca Lee, and I turned back to it, and there's just a little two sentences that really struck with me. The more we practice, the more we realize that we need to practice. After a while, we cannot imagine not practicing. Practice is life. And it's just how we churn it after a while, that, you know, it's going to be there. It's going to keep changing. But it is a second nature. I mean, it's like, we're all looking, we're all searchers, we're all wanderers, at least in our Sangha. The other people aren't. I mean, it's like, nothing I can do about that. But it's we're so fortunate now to have all these resources available to us.
Yeah.
Raise your hand, for me, I feel like I have my personal life
and I have my professional life. And in my professional life, I need to give orders, right? I need to make sure that people are on top of their task, and I need to tell them what to do. And if they're not doing it, I need to tell them that they're not doing it and to explain them what to do, right? And meaning I can do it in a nicer way, but it's part of my job. And when you do it, and like I know, I notice it, when you do it, unfortunately, more than 9 hours a day, more into the 11 hours a day, it's kind of becoming like something that you, this is kind of like how your brain is working, and this is how things are working. And now when you go back into your personal life, like, no, that was work. Now in my personal life, I need to train my brain completely different, but it's very confusing, right? Like, so when I'm not working on my weekends, I'm really able to be the present person that I want to be, and to see, and in my relationship with everyone, right? But on my work days, I'm not, and I'm stuck, and I don't know, like, do I need to quit my job for that? It's not terrible, but like it, I'm very far from where I want to feel. Yeah. And I know how it can feel when I'm not working. So I'm like, oh.
I think that's just one of those fascinating, like, life koan opportunity to like bring practice right into life, right? Because you're like, what is it on the weekends? What is different? You know, I'm not asking you right now, but yeah. Like, what is it different on the weekends? Like, what is just, you know, different in your mind? It's just a sense of, probably your sense of time is different and whatever. And then, you know, you contrast that with like, okay, there you are after work and exhausted and whatever. But it strikes me that this could be, you know, like I was saying, when I said I wanted to live each day as if it was my last, I mean, I was very, very, very far from that. And I was just kind of like, yeah, I'd like to be like that someday. But just kind of holding that, like, you know, what, how would I have to practice? What would I have to do to like make that transition and be home, even though I'm exhausted, even though I'm in that mode? And then at some point you kind of like, you figure it out. And so I would guess that, like, I don't know, a year from now, a couple years from now, 5-10 years from now, you'd be just like, you know,
I can now,
well, that's true too, but but you can recognize that is, you, like you said, that is the most difficult situation. So we also have to give ourselves a break and just be like, you know, well, sometimes my practice looks great in the most difficult situations. After 24 hours in the Boise airport, I wasn't very mindful.
Yeah.
But thanks for sharing. All right. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Prajna, Paramita.
Thank you so much, Domyo. So helpful.
Thanks for being here, Ruthann.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.